This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. The plan to build a minor league baseball stadium in Hartford and the way the idea was rolled out has been criticized on many fronts. Primarily, it's the cost, up to $60 million borrowed to develop a stadium in the city's downtown North neighborhood, with no private investment yet in the works. Last week on Where We Live, Hartford Mayor Pedro Segarra told us that the city would seek private investment.
Where we are now is that within a week's time, based on the responses that we've gotten from the private sector in terms of interest with being partners, to solicit proposals for a public-private partnership that will afford us the opportunity to do what everyone really wants us to do, to have a stadium, to have that stadium built with private participation, lessen the burden on the taxpayers.
But this all raises questions about the scope of the development around the ballpark, how it might all fit in with already existing plans to develop the area, the need for a local supermarket, whether the whole plan will pan out after all, even after being declared a done deal by city officials. Today, Where We Live, we'll dig in deeper to a massive plan that's pitted Hartford against New Britain and has lined up opponents from a wide spectrum of Connecticut life. Last week, we got the take from city officials. Today, we hear from some critics and observers of the city's ballpark plan. We want to hear from you. You can join the conversation, 860-275-7266. You can comment on our website, WNPR.org. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, at Where We Live. Coming up later this hour, as they get ready to lose their ball club, we'll look at another piece of New Britain history, the manufacturing legacy that gave it the name the Hardware City. Katie Tolarski will introduce us to the people who remember the days when New Britain manufacturing was humming. But first, let me welcome in our guest, David Panagor. He's from Urban Mechanics. He's also former development director of the city of Hartford. Good to see you, David.
Good morning, John.
Joining me in studio is Ken Krajewski. He's an attorney. He's also part of the Hartford Coalition to Stop the Stadium. We've heard from Ken many times in the program, but it's good to see you in person. Ken, thanks for being here.
Great, John. Thanks for having me.
And also joining us is Eric Coleman, who's a state senator who represents Hartford, Bloomfield, and Windsor. Senator, thank you for coming in.
Good morning. It's good to be here. Thank you for having me.
I want to turn to you, Senator, first, because what we heard from last week was city officials who are very enthusiastic, some a little bit skeptical, but overall enthusiastic about the idea of bringing minor league baseball to the city of Hartford. What's your take? What do you think?
Well, I'm trying to figure out where this enthusiasm would come from. And I guess what is appalling is the lack of any kind of critical analysis over the stadium. It really appears to me as if they were eager to announce something that would make it appear to the public as if they were doing something, and beyond that would make it appear as if they were doing something good. And it's beyond me how you could mention a price tag of $60 million and not ask the critical question, how is that money going to be paid for, or how is that price going to be met? And it seems that that's what they did.
But before we get into some of the specifics about what we know and don't know about the deal, let me just make sure I understand what part, if any, you or others at the state legislature played in this. During the 16, 17, or 18 months that this deal was being negotiated between the city and the owners of the New Britain Rockettes in secret, as we talked about last week, were you ever notified about this? Did you get any wind that this is something the city was planning?
I didn't hear about it until the day that the press conference was scheduled. And I don't even recall whether I was invited to be a part of the press conference or not, but that's the first that I got any wind that there was even a remote idea of bringing a baseball stadium to Hartford.
When it comes to a big development like this in a city like Hartford, that obviously is, it's a major employer, it's one of the largest cities in the state, but it's also the seat of state government. Normally, would the lawmakers who represent the city be intimately involved? Maybe you can give us an example of another case where something was happening at the city level where you were notified. Maybe you just give us a better sense of how this normally works.
Well, I think typically what would happen is that the delegation would be briefed. Comparable development proposals, maybe Adrian's Landing, the convention center, even when there was some notion that the Patriots might want to come to Hartford. I think we were informed and made aware of it and pretty much kept abreast. I wouldn't say that we were intimately involved in the discussions or even intimately informed about every single detail. But There was certainly an effort to include the legislative delegation that represents Hartford in those kinds of proposals.
A lot of people have made comparisons to the attempt to bring the Patriots to Hartford. Do you see parallels to all this? The Kraft family cutting a deal with former Governor John Rowland, having a big press conference, not unlike the one that we had not so long ago, saying, you know, it's a done deal. The Patriots are coming and the handing over the football, and then everything kind of falls apart. An awful lot of the people who didn't think it was a good idea in the first place took some glee in the fact that it didn't happen, but essentially it was a very big deal that a lot of people didn't think was going to happen, and then it sort of fizzled away. Do you see some parallels here?
There may be, but you know, I guess there was just, to me, a lack of due diligence regarding this particular proposal. I think the press conference was premature. Private financing appears to be an afterthought. I don't know how that could possibly have taken place. If you're talking about $60 million, I think the first thing you should say at a press conference is that we're embarking upon a public-private partnership. And just the lack of due diligence, even with the Patriots, I guess there is a similarity because the Rockettes management apparently made some assertion to the city that they were considering some proposal from Springfield to take the team to Springfield.
And we talked to officials in Springfield who said that there was no such overture, that conversation didn't happen.
Yeah, if you could talk to officials from Springfield, I'm not sure why anybody from the city wouldn't at least have the idea to reach out to Springfield to see if that was in fact the case.
We're talking with Eric Coleman. He's a state senator who represents Hartford, and we're talking about the deal struck by the city to bring the minor league New Britain Rockettes from New Britain to Hartford. Coming up later on, we'll be talking with somebody from New Britain who's none too happy about this. We want to hear some of your voices as well at 860-275-7266. Just a moment, we're going to turn to David Panagore, who is the former development director for the city, to talk about the possibilities for a development of this type to work. But I want to bring in Ken Krajewski, who's part of this Hartford Coalition to Stop the Stadium. You're really looking at it from a taxpayer standpoint, Ken, from a city resident standpoint. When you heard about this plan, what was the first thing you thought?
I can't believe they're that dumb. I mean, okay, who wouldn't? What corporation wouldn't accept $60 million in taxpayer largesse? What corporation would say, oh, I'm not going to have anything to do with this deal? The owners of the Rockettes were able to play the city like a fiddle, and this is the city entered into a bad deal. And when I think about what this bad deal is, Senator Coleman talked about the lack of due diligence. Last week on this show, the mayor revealed he didn't even read the lease in its entirety. He's a lawyer. It's a 58-page lease. Sit down with a cup of coffee and run through it. He didn't know that there were skyboxes. He didn't know what the deal that he was pitching even contained, which to me is deeply, deeply troubling. Then he comes back and he says, well, we're going to bring in private investment. But after we've uncovered a bunch of the mistruths, half-truths, and untruths that he's spoken about this, he has no credibility whatsoever to be speaking further. And I don't know how any other developer can do business with the city with this lack of credibility that's been revealed. And
well, one of the things that I think that you've just talked about, and we've heard many complaints about, and the senator has just talked about, is the process. The fact that this was done behind closed doors. We didn't know about this. It seems like an awful lot of money to be spending, certainly borrowing for the city on a project like this. Let's take a look at this, Ken, from just the standpoint of is this something that could work if done right? As you know, representing the voices of many people in the city, if the city could find a way to publicly, privately finance a ballpark to bring minor league baseball to Hartford and help develop a part of the North End that has just been laying vacant for years, for as long as any of us can remember, might that be a good idea?
John, I've got a great idea. Why don't we take $60 million and instead of giving it to a corporate person who may be endowed with more rights than an actual human being based on yesterday's Supreme Court ruling, why don't we take $60 million and invest it in housing for single women of color who are mothers, who don't have opportunities like the Solomons do because they're actually not even putting a dime into this project.
And again, the Solomons, the owners of the Rockettes.
So from my perspective, they're to quote a famous person. Not a dime of public money goes into this project. I can't see it. The Solomons have $2 billion worth of real estate in Massachusetts and in Virginia. I just don't think that the role of government is to give billionaires more money.
So let's turn to David Panagore and just talk for a moment about this idea of whether or not private money can fit into this plan at this particular point. As we heard the mayor and the other city officials say, they didn't talk about private investment up front, but they're saying that private investment could be part of it now. I asked directly, does that mean private investment to help build the stadium? And they said, no, private investment for the areas around the stadium, which clearly need to be developed one way or another. I guess first thing I'll ask you, Dave, is do you think that a plan like this works? We first of all say we're going to borrow a whole bunch of money in order to pay for a stadium, and then we go look for private development.
Well, a concept like this can work. It's been shown all across the country that minor league ballparks can, in certain instances, if done right, be a very big economic benefit to the community. But the key phrase is they're done right. At this juncture, it's the clock that's really the problem. It took 17 months to get to this deal that everybody's talked about in various ways. And the city hopes in the next 45 days to come up with a developer who's going to be able to do a deal at, what, $500 million maybe gross value for the entire area? I mean, and the issue is adding a ballpark to the city doesn't change the market fundamentals. People in the region still earn $24,000, still earn $36,000. That doesn't change. And so if it was a problem last week to build housing without public subsidy, it's still going to be a problem next week. So this is an incredibly complex deal up there, and to do this development is going to take – should take reasonably a year to really come up with a good deal. Otherwise, if you're forced to only do a deal in 45 days and you're already scrambling, you're probably going to get a lot of bottom feeders.
I want to make sure I understand something from your perspective. Again, having run the city as the COO, been the development director, and obviously been a professional in this world for some time, David, I wonder if you could address a little bit of what Ken just had to say, because much of what we heard from Hartford residents and residents of the area is, look, here's a city that can't pay its bills. Here's a city that has broken down roads and it doesn't have the services necessary for the people of the city. It, for goodness sakes, it doesn't have the supermarket that we've often talked about in a food desert in the north end of the city where people could shop for reasonably priced food. But is it realistic from a development standpoint to say we'll just take the $60 million that we might have spent on a ballpark and say instead we're going to invest that $60 million, that's borrowed money, in things like the things Ken just laid out? I mean, is that a realistic way of doing development?
It's a question. It's really, though, a question of social priorities, because there are cities that believe the solution to their problems is building everyone a home. There are cities that believe, and I agree with this, that the way to get everybody a home is actually to give them a good job. If we actually had manufacturing, we wouldn't need to do a public welfare transfer to help people have housing. They'd do it on their own. We don't have jobs. We need to create industry here in real jobs and tax-paying properties. The problem here is right now so far we've got 60 jobs being moved from New Britain maybe, and we've got support of all the other existing jobs. We don't as yet have a development scenario up there that shows that we're creating an industry or creating jobs. And so I think it's not reasonable to say it has to always be one or the other. A city actually has to chew bubblegum and walk at the same time. We have to invest in social services and we have to invest in development. But it's up to the community to decide what the priorities are.
Talk, Eric Coleman, if you would, before we take our break, about creating jobs in the city of Hartford. Obviously, it's been something that the city has wanted to do for years. We talked about the reality or unreality of the jobs numbers that were put out in the original proposal. 600 full-time jobs would be created by this baseball park development, which I think even the development director, Tom Deller, said wasn't right. So how do we get at that? How do we make some sort of an investment that actually does get the 600 or 1,000 or 2,000 jobs that probably the people of the city, especially that neighborhood we're building, in need?
Well, we don't do it certainly by an ill-conceived proposal for a baseball stadium. Hartford's economic base traditionally had been financial services, tourism and entertainment, the defense industry, and I think of those – financial services in Hartford has been on the decline. Manufacturing, as David has indicated, has been on the decline. But I think the challenge for us as policymakers is to broaden the tax base of the city of Hartford. And, you know, other states, I guess, have been aggressive and other cities have been aggressive about trying to go out and recruiting companies and firms to relocate. I think that's part of what we may have to do. But, you know, the whole objective, I guess, is to expand the tax base. And perhaps put some of those people who are depending upon social services and human services into jobs so that they can, in fact, fend for themselves and reach the ideal of becoming taxpayers themselves.
And how have you thought about that, Ken? Because I think that that is – it's a key thing that we keep hearing from people, that it's not really just about finding a way to care for the people of Hartford who've been struggling for so long. It really is about trying to jumpstart something. And to be fair, the city officials who, you know, you don't like this plan. A lot of people don't like this plan. But they're saying we got to do something to jumpstart some sort of economic development, to bring in some sort of development into the city from the outside so that people will be able to have those jobs.
To me, John, a stadium is a tired economic development proposal that's tried and failed many other places. Let's look at where can Hartford generate economic activity? What natural resources do we have? We have human capital and we have a lot of trash. Okay, why hasn't the mayor taken $1 million and created a biofuels company to recycle all the grease in cafeterias and restaurants across the city to turn it into biodiesel for our school buses? It would reduce pollution, and so maybe it's 15 jobs there. Those are better jobs that are going to continue for the long term because we're not giving up French fries anytime soon. You know, those are long-term jobs that we could go on forever. Okay, let's look at all the furniture that we see on the side of the road. Why don't we take that and figure out ways we can reuse the wood? There are little – look, if we take 10 jobs here and 15 jobs here and 20 jobs here, there are plenty of micro enterprises that we can be investing in that I don't feel like a big shiny box like this development is proposed to will do. I mean,
Well, and one thing I just want to put, because we have to take a break, just to put to David Panagor, is in the world of development, there's a lot of different ways to look at this. One is, you know, spending a lot of money to do something very, very big. But even the amount of money paid to consultants or lawyers to look at a stadium proposal is the tens of thousands of dollars that could go right under the street to do everything from some sort of grassroots effort to clean up a block, to remake a neighborhood, to try to do something. Can it really work in that way that Ken's suggesting?
I don't think the voters actually appreciate the small project approach. I think the problem is people do not want the 10 and 20 years it's going to take to do a whole bunch of small projects to build up. People want instant answers, and they've been spending 30 years in the city. And this is the frustration that city officials wind up with because they're faced with needing solutions now. And those little projects are great. But the problem with those little projects are you need an infrastructure that can support it, and you're picking winners and losers. And every time you choose an industry that fails, every time you choose a small thing that fails, you get a ding. And so it's incredibly complex. It looks easy. An idea is an easy thing to talk about. But in execution, those sort of incubator programs, no one has the solution on those yet. And those are incredibly hard to do.
But I just have to stop you quickly and say I think you're right in its essence and the political realities of this. Mm. But when you talk about voters' demand, I mean, in a city like Hartford, when you say voters, we're talking about 20% of the people showing up for elections. We're talking about a minuscule number of people making the decisions based on this. I mean, it almost seems as though the political will might need to extend beyond just the thought about can I keep my job because I got an extra dozen votes to actually keep it this time around. I mean,
but
that's the small numbers we're talking
about.
Sure,
but politicians all the time make calculated risks about how can I stay in office longer to do good while making a decision today that isn't so great. It happens all the time.
I want to go to Mary in Hartford who wants to pick up on something Ken's talking about. Mary, go ahead quickly if you would.
I would like to just mention that the MDC is spending $50 million per year in the city of Hartford, up to $1 billion in the next 10 years, as they have in the 10 years before, much of it's state money. And the city leadership could prioritize green infrastructure, work with the MDC, and create green jobs, entry-level jobs for green infrastructure if that were of value, but it's not. It's funneling the money into private individuals like the Solomon family or whatever, instead of really looking at what is a collaborative state and regional project that's good for the future.
Mary, thank you very much for your phone call. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll get to some more of your phone calls. We'll also bring into the conversation Adrian Barron, who's an attorney in New Britain. He's been sponsoring a Polish night at the Rock Cats Stadium in New Britain. He's canceled that. He's a little bit upset that the team is moving to Hartford. We'll get his take from New Britain. We'll also take a look at the industrial history of New Britain later on in our program here on Where We Live. This is Where We Live.
Do either of you have any thoughts about the Rockettes moving to Hartford?
I think it's going to be, like, chaotic.
Yeah, it's going to, if traffic isn't bad enough already, wait till there's a Rockettes game going on. It's going to be mayhem. But I think other than that, I mean, it's good. It's I think the city's needed sports for a while. Like, I mean, losing the Whalers definitely hurt things, I think. I mean, it's only going to generate more money.
Yeah, I heard about that. That was surprising. And I think it's sounds like fun. It would be within striking distance to our office, I think. We're right over here, right? Yeah, it sounds good.
No, I've heard it. I mean, I saw what they had built in New Britain for a newer stadium and all. I understand about revitalizing Hartford and all that, but it seems like, you know, I played at the old stadium. The old field was nice and stuff in New Britain. They built a new one. They've been drawing pretty well. I didn't see the need.
Some voices from downtown Hartford talking about the imminent move of the New Britain Rockettes to downtown Hartford. We're talking with some folks who've been taking a look at this deal. Last week, we talked with city officials. We're talking with some folks who have questions about it. David Panagor from Urban Mechanics, he's former development director for the city of Hartford and also former COO. Ken Krajewski is here as well. His column is called The 40-Year Plan. He's an attorney and part of the Hartford Coalition to Stop the Stadium. And we're also joined by Eric Coleman, who's a state senator representing Hartford, Bloomfield, and Windsor. We're going to get to your phone calls in just a moment at 860-275-7266. But I want to bring in briefly Adrian Barron, who's an attorney, executive director of the Polonia Business Association, based in New Britain. Adrian, welcome to our program. Thanks so much for joining us.
Good morning, John. Thanks for having me.
So you have sponsored, your law firm has sponsored Polish Night at the ballpark. Of course, the Polish community in New Britain, a big part of that community. You decided to cancel that after the move was announced. Tell us about why you decided to do that.
Oh, sure, John. Well, after the announcement, interest among our members just dropped. Our group's been working on developing the Little Poland business district in New Britain, and we were really pushing to start some kind of relationship with the team, or perhaps you come with a ticket from the game, you get a discount at one of the Little Poland restaurants. We brought about 130 fans last year. They let us have our neighborhood mascot, Stanley the Dragon, throw out the first pitch. It was a great event, but the interest just dropped. Our thought was we weren't going to use our community's money to pay for moving boxes.
Mm. So do you think that this is going to really leave a mark in the city? Obviously, New Britain is one of the, you know, smaller communities to have a double-A baseball team. Is this something that the people of New Britain are going to easily forget? Do you think that the people of New Britain are actually going to hop on that brand new busway and come downtown and watch the Rockettes play in the north end of Hartford?
Well, New Britain's, you know, they call us hard hitting New Britain. You know, we'll survive this, but I just don't understand the ownership. I mean, the dynamic in New Britain, they were the big game in town. You had a lot of local communities with strong Little League programs. We were filling the stands every night. We did everything we were supposed to. And there's 30 years of success with minor league ball in New Britain. And not to knock Hartford, but, you know, they're like the Bermuda Triangle of sports. And we just don't understand why would you mess with that dynamic where you're getting the fans here. You know, to go to Hartford, we just think it's nuts.
The Bermuda Triangle of sports. Hang on to the line, Adrian, because I want to get to our other guests very quickly. Eric Coleman, I think something that we haven't talked enough about, I don't think, is the regional planning implications of this. You obviously, in the state legislature, you represent Hartford, but also outlying communities. You have to think not just about your city, but about how the city plays in the region. And one of the first things I thought about as well, we're spending an awful lot of money to build a busway that could very well be a good thing connecting Hartford and New Britain, at least a step toward some sort of connectivity and public transportation in the area. And now we'd be spending a lot of public money to move a baseball team that same distance to 17 miles down the road. From a regional planning standpoint, how does all this strike you?
Not very well. I've been an advocate of regional cooperation and intermunicipal cooperation. As I was trying to make the point earlier, I think there's been a lack of planning and coordination with respect to this proposal altogether. And not just the supermarket and the implications that the baseball stadium would have on the supermarket, but there's been so much discussion about improvements to I-84 and the viaduct at I-84. And it doesn't appear to me as if anyone has stopped to think, how does the construction of a baseball stadium impact, for good or for bad, all of the discussion and all of the plans regarding I-84.
And this is a plan, of course, the DOT has been looking at for quite some time. David Panagor, I know it's something that while you were working for the city, they were talking about. They're going to be talking about 20 years from now, certainly. I mean, what do you think this means? We heard one of our men on the street interviews saying, you know, traffic's going to be a problem because it's being built at the confluence of 95 and 91, or excuse me, of 91 and 84, two highways that may very well be under big construction in the coming years.
It's actually at a great it's 100% corner because it's the meeting of all the highways in the region. That's a good thing. The bad thing is it's got the shortest exit ramp around. The Trumbull Street exit, which could serve at the same time in a summer night, the Meadows plus the ballpark, I think before you even get to the 84 question, you may need to expand the Trumbull Street exit by one lane. Because your ability to get people in and out of the area may be very challenged on those nights. There needs to be a traffic study done about access for what they call the peak event. And we're going to have 70 peak events every summer now. In terms of 84, the problem is, given the amount of – it takes the state 2 years right now just to review a roadway design. The idea that we're going to have to stop and do no development north of 84 until 84 gets done – well, we all may, you know, have white hair and be in a retirement home before that happens. So the city is got to act before then. Whether it can work in conjunction with it, I have a different theory. And that is, as was said by the Urban Land Institute 7 years ago, and that is north of 84 has to develop as its own area. Main Street and south of 84 has to develop as its own area. And over the course of time, if they grow vibrant enough, they can connect. But there is no connectivity over 84 until it disappears. And building over 84 is probably the most costly activity you can possibly imagine. And coming up with the $20 billion, let's call it $10 billion. Is the state going to come up with $10 billion? The federal government doesn't even have a federal highway program right now. The federal highway fund is broke. So our ability to do 84 in the short term is fairly limited, and the city is probably going to have to develop, whether it's this Brown plan or some other, before the 84 gets done, I hate to say.
Ken, I'd love you to weigh in on the transportation piece of this. I know that you've been involved in some litigation surrounding the fast track, the Connecticut busway that's moving from Hartford to New Britain. What's your take on this piece of it?
Well, we want pedestrians and bicyclists to be included, and it's clear that this current administration ignores bicyclists because they're about to do a major project on Bushnell Park, expanding a 30-foot sidewalk. And I saw the shovels in the ground on Friday, and I asked the engineers, where's the bike lane? And they said, there is none. Bicycles can ride on the sidewalks. No. So this administration has a very big blind spot for walkable, bikeable cities. And to that end, we want to show exactly how dangerous this is going to be for pedestrians. But we also want to show – on July 21st, before the next city council meeting that has a hearing on this, we're going to do a march from the stadium site, 1212 Main Street, all the way down to City Hall. And people can go to the Hartford Coalition to Stop the Stadium's Facebook page to learn more about that. But we want to show people that we do want to be able to bridge 84, but we need to create pedestrian-based infrastructure. And I think the proposed supermarket with mixed-use housing, and that would have been a great way to develop pedestrian infrastructure at that site. And now that's lost.
If I may, I hate to break in, but I have to disagree, Ken. And I don't know who – I don't always get my – sometimes I get my information from the construction guy standing there. But the entire iQuilt design, which is that's a part of, is about building a walkable downtown. And whether an execution they've achieved it right now okay, there are 75 people. There's an entire board. There's an entire plan. It's all about walkability that the city has endorsed as part of its master plan. Whether it's happening in execution, I can't speak to. But the idea that the city is opposed to walkable, bikeable places is just palpably not true.
But I don't see bike lanes, David.
Then let's go back and look at the design. Let's not ask the guy who's pouring concrete what the eventual use is, because it could be in the design.
These were the engineers.
Here's what I'd just like to ask, and it's one of the things that I asked city officials when they were here, David, is when we have a plan like the one we're talking about here around the ballpark that may or may not fit with existing plans that have been talked about and vetted through public hearings for quite some time, whether it's a downtown north development or an iQuilt development. People who are listening in Cheshire right now go, what the hell is iQuilt? I don't know what you're talking about. But essentially, the city of Hartford's been trying to make itself a more walkable, bikeable place with better signage over the years to try to get at some of the things that vibrant urban centers have. This ballpark plan seems to, in some ways, disrupt some of the planning that's already gone into making downtown north part of the city.
This is what happens when you got to scramble, when you've got to be doing two processes at the same time. I'm not quite sure that this thing should have been done in secret for 17 months. Maybe it was only should have been 3 months, 4 months. But there should have been much more public discussion to do exactly what you're talking about, John, where you can fit it in with your plans. Right now, everybody is scrambling. And when you scramble, you wind up forgetting things and leaving things out. And part of what winds up getting left out is things like sidewalks and other amenities because you don't have time. I know the city would like to do it, but my opinion is the city needs another year, just like all these other plans, to be able to get this right.
And we're talking here about the development of a ballpark, a stadium in downtown Hartford for a minor league baseball team that would move from New Britain to Hartford. We're talking with David Panagor, Ken Kryeski, Eric Coleman. On the phone is Adrian Barron. We just got a few minutes left in our conversation. I want to quickly play for you, David, something. We talked to Thomas Deller, who's the city's development director, about the hiring of a consultant through a lawyer, and if it meets the city's procurement rules. I'll explain a bit in a moment, but here's what Tom Deller had to say.
It's a normal practice that we have used a few times. It's just a way to keep things moving forward and get it done in a timely manner. We require that when we do that, the firm that's doing the hiring for us meet the city's requirements of getting at least three proposals and do the analysis to meet all the city procurement rules. But it's a way to keep projects moving given the demands that we have on our staff at times.
And so that's Jeff Cohen, our reporter who's been following this, asking Tom Deller about this. And the reason I want to put this to you, David, former development director of the city, former COO of the city, what do you know about the procurement rules when we talk about this being done behind closed doors over quite some time? Essentially, what it seems as though the city did was hired a lawyer who then, without going out to bid, hired a consultant to put together this deal. Does that jive with the city's rules?
Well, part of being the COO of the city is you're actually the city's procurement agent as well. In the times that I was there, recollection, we once, in relation to litigation or employee performance reviews or things like that, the police study that we recently did with Markham, that was done through the law department. So sometimes it does occur. In a development deal, when you have lawyers, sometimes you do bring on people. But in this instance, the only time we did this was we did a study for the Excel Center that became the basis of the $35 million worth of improvements. That was done. We solicited a couple quotes. There was you didn't have to put it in the paper, but we solicited them. So hiring this way, I have to say, is a bit unusual and is frankly usually done when you're in a situation where you need it not to be public.
But all that said, does it strictly comply with the rules of the city? I mean, does it skirt any rules that you know of?
I am challenged to believe that it is in full compliance, yet at the same time, could a justification be made? I think it's probably something for internal audit to look at.
We got a comment on our website from Jose who says, will the reintegration of the North End community by introducing the Rockettes to its backyard make Hartford whole once again? Maybe not, but it's an admirable effort by city officials. Community inclusion is imperative, not just for economic sustainability, but for its social and cultural survival. Eric Coleman, I'll just put that to you, Senator. You know, once again, some people are going to say maybe this is something that could work and it could help spark something in the city. Maybe this development of the North End is just what the city needs.
I certainly agree with the point about community inclusion. That is something that I think is absolutely necessary in order for the city to progress and advance in a positive way. But back to my point about the lack of due diligence, municipally owned stadiums are from what I understand, to be particular and specialized kinds of developments. And the key point about that is that if they're done wrong, it could have some negative impact. It could, in fact, impair the city's bond rating. And so it is very important that the transparency that all of us would like to see, the inclusion that all of us would like to see, actually take place. And it's beyond me why, if you're talking about the issuance of $60 million worth of bonds, the city treasurer was not even included in the discussion.
You were nodding your head, David. I just want to get your quick take on this, the idea of the bond rating perhaps being somewhat in jeopardy.
I mean, the city can afford this. The last thing of its size was the public safety complex. But if it goes south and goes bad, it will have the impact on this on the city's bond rating. In the last 20 deals for minor league parks that have been done, none of them have been done solely on the back of the municipality. So this is a huge roll of the dice and a huge risk. City can afford it. Taxes would have to go up. But there's implicit risk, as the senator points out, and I agree entirely.
David Panagore is from Urban Mechanics. He's a former development director and COO of the city of Hartford. Thank you very much, David. I appreciate it. Thanks also to Eric Coleman, who's a state senator who represents Hartford, among other communities. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
And I want to thank Ken Kryeski, who's an attorney, who also writes the column, The 40-Year Plan, and he's part of the Hartford Coalition to Stop the Stadium. Thanks so much for coming in, Ken.
Thank you, John.
I also want to thank Adrian Barron, who's an attorney, and he's executive director of the Polonia Business Association based in New Britain. Thank you for your time, sir. I appreciate it.
Thank you, John.
If you want to know more about the history of New Britain's Polish community and to add your own story, go to our special project page. It's polishstories.wnpr.org. Coming up, Katie Talarski takes us on a historical tour of New Britain manufacturing and talks to the men and women who made it the hardware city. This is Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on tomorrow's show, it looks like the world's largest hedge fund won't be building a new headquarters in Stanford. What does that say about the state's economic development plans? And a charter school organization faces investigation of its finances and operations. What does that say about the school reform movement? We'll look at those stories and much more coming up in The Wheelhouse, our weekly news roundtable. That's tomorrow on Where We Live. As we've been covering on the show today, New Britain stands to lose its baseball team to Hartford. It could be another blow to a city that over the years has lost many of its jobs and many of the iconic brands associated with the city. In fact, in 1995, when the baseball team shed its identity as the New Britain Red Sox, it actually didn't take the New Britain name at first. Instead, it identified with the city's traditional nickname and called the team the Hardware City Rockettes. So what was Hardware City like in its heyday? Well, today it's kind of hard to imagine a packed downtown New Britain with 35,000 workers in the factories and life revolving around those factories. Through the mid-20th century, the city saw an influx of immigrants. Many picked up in New York City after a long journey overseas and brought to New Britain to live with families or friends and work here. WNPR's executive producer Katie Talarski explored the history of New Britain, a city that still thinks of itself as the hardware city of the world and the people who worked in its factories.
You can barely find the Industrial Museum in downtown New Britain. It's tucked back on the second floor of an office building, a small space jam-packed with old household goods, tools, maps, and treasures that tell the story of a city that at one time was absolutely a center of industry.
It's not that New Britain is better or different than anybody else. This story has been played over and over and over across America for 200 years. What I think sets New Britain apart is the five different industries.
Karen Hudkins is the powerhouse behind the New Britain Industrial Museum. She knows the story of the city by heart. I talked to her just after she had given a museum tour to a group of what looked like high school kids. This is a spiel she's given many, many times.
It's ball bearings, which are huge. It's household goods, Landersferry and Clark, kitchen implements, North and Judd making buckles and clips and things like that. It's tools made by New Britain Machine tools, Stanley Roll and Level hand tools. It's manufacturing machines, New Britain Machine, which were sold all over the world. And it was builder's hardware, which is Stanley and P.F. Corbin and Russell and Irwin and actually Union Manufacturing. So a lot of companies were making the same things, but there was so much need for this in this country, and it was all being sold around the world, that you could have three companies making hinges. They were just different types of hinges.
Ball bearings, household goods, builders' hardware, tools, and manufacturing machinery. Five industries that at their height in the mid-20th century employed 35,000 people. Today, Stanley is a lone survivor of all those factories in New Britain. But remnants like doorknobs, hinges, and ball bearings are still found all over the world, made by companies with names like Fafner, Landers, and North & Judd.
It's kind of hard to wrap your mind around all these numbers. You know, it just becomes, you know, you hear, yes, New Britain's the hardware city of the world. Well, what does that really mean? Well, I think Corbin and Russell and Irwin are a good example of that because they made builder's hardware. And by the late 1800s, when the Transcontinental Railroad, I think it's only 30 years old, Corbin's selling doorknobs to a guy named Klaus Spreckels because he's putting up an office building in San Francisco in the 1890s, and it's filled with Corbin hardware. Every door had a monogrammed doorknob made in New Britain for Mr. Spreckels. And then during the Depression, they get the contract for Rockefeller Center. Think how many doorknobs that is. And then at the other end of the century, actually the architects who put up the World Trade Center came to this area for the hardware. And Russell and Irwin and Corbin did the hardware for the executive suites. And Stanley actually did the architectural hinges. So even though manufacturing had changed in America, another iconic building goes up and they came up here to get their hardware because that's where you came.
Anybody that grew up in Britain knows all about the factories in Britain. Landers, Fafners, North & Judd, Russell & Irwin.
That's Alan Nelson. He spent a few years at Stanley before becoming a fireman. His father worked at Landers.
And my stepmother worked in Landers. They both worked in Landers. Well, from what I know, he worked in the chopper room. He used to work a surface grinder of some sort. And used to grind cutters and things like that to put the sharp edges on them. You know what food chopper is? Well, there were different size cutters, small ones, big ones. And he would put them on a surface grinder all day, I guess, put sharp edges on them and grind them. That was his job.
Then my grandfather, on my father's side, worked in Landers, and he worked in a foundry.
Ed Prendergast spent time working at Stanley in the 1960s.
My father graduated, or I guess you call it graduated, out of 8th grade or 9th grade, whatever it was, and he went to the factory. He never finished high school, and my mother didn't either as well. And both of them, my father ended up being a general foreman. And so in those days, you know, education was carried along. You picked it up as you went if you were able or if you were interested in it. And so he did very well. He was a young foreman, one of the youngest foremen at Landers at the time.
Prendergast said that families had loyalties to certain factories, but there were plenty of jobs to go around.
People have said that you could get laid off or fired from a job in the morning, walk down the street, and be hired after lunch somewhere else. So it was, you know, jobs were plentiful and available.
Jobs were plentiful, but it was hard work. The goal of many families was to work hard so that the next generation wouldn't have to spend long hours in a factory.
My father always drummed into me, don't get in the factory. And many of the people who worked laborers in a factory would tell their children that was their goal, was to get the next generation out and somewhere else. And it was kind of not a very pleasant place to work, particularly in some of the areas. In some of the places I worked were pretty, you know, ugly places.
But many people like Tina Langevin worked in the factories for years and enjoyed it. She worked at Stanley from 1981 to 1999. She still gets excited when she talks about making hinges.
Okay, you would assemble them. Okay, first of all, let me say they would come in on a large steel ring, like you would hook it up to. The setters would weave it through the machines and blank out your parts. Okay, then it goes through, like, processes, and then you have to, like, roll them. They have to be deburred. Then they would come over to us. We'd have whether we had the ball bearings or not, the tips, the pins, the grease, and the hinge. You'd put it all together. It was a process. Like I say, we all worked, you know, together. It would go down the line. After it was assembled, it would go into plating. After it was, whether you wanted a US-3 finish or, you know, I used to remember all the finishes, brass, dull brass. whatever finish you wanted on it. Then it would go through inspection. And then, of course, quality control would re-inspect that after we did. And then we'd pack it. It would go down to the shipping room, and there it would go on the pallets, waiting for the trucks to come and take the hinges out.
Langevin was one of many women working at Stanley.
Other than the foremen, the leaders, the setters, most of the workers were women. And they were, of course, when I went in there, I was a child, I was 20. And when I went in, and there were these, like, there's Polish women, Italian women, French women. And I remember going in there, and I'm green, and I don't know what's going on, and I'm scared. And, you know, they come right over to you, and now I'm going to show you how to do this. And you do it like the, so the women were there to help you. Of course, we did get paid less.
Although she's now a certified nurse's assistant, she misses the factory days.
I think we did a darn good job, myself, the people that I worked with through the years, what we did, what we put out, what we made. I mean, it means something to me. I know I made a difference. I did something. And I can always look back at that and take some of what I've learned with me. Like I say, I can hang a door. I can change a lot, you know. And I'm proud that how many women can do that? I mean, probably a lot. But so I was, you know, really like, I'm glad that I was there. I wish we still were, but everything comes to pass. But it was a great time in my life. I really enjoyed it. I'll always miss it.
My name is Phil, as in Philip Pearson, P-E-A-R-S-O-N, and I came to New Britain to work at the Fafner Bearing Company in the end of June of 1950, right after graduating from college.
Phil Pearson is a metallurgist. He worked at Fafner for 50 years.
Well, I liked working with all the people. Fafner, it's an overused term, but it was very much a family where people took care of each other, and even if you weren't in the department you worked for, you were known everywhere and expected to be everywhere. This is a personal story, but after I'd been there about 5 years or so, I was 25 or 26, and I think they began to worry about me because I wasn't married yet. You know, this was back in the 50s, people got married. And one of the superintendents happened, incidentally, to be president, I guess, of the parent-teacher PTA at one of the local elementary schools. And they were putting on a skit show. This is just the parents. This had nothing to do with the students at all. And they needed a piano player to fill in their orchestra. So he got me over to be the piano player, at which point I met the music teacher, and a year later we got married. So when I say that Fafner is a family, people like that. They take an interest in each other.
Pearson told me that when he and his wife were looking for a house, they couldn't afford anything in New Britain, so they bought property in an affordable suburb, Farmington. Karen Hudkins, director of the museum, collects people's stories as much as she collects paraphernalia. Many of the former factory workers volunteer for her as docents. They want to keep the history alive as much as she does.
As all communities struggle with what their identity is in the 21st century and post-industrialist, we have to remember, particularly in New Britain, that it was people who built all this, and it is going to be the people who figure out what is going to make us strong and successful in the 21st century. And I think sometimes we forget that. And that's what happens when you become disconnected from your own history.
You can hear more factory worker stories and see photos at our website, WNPR.org, and at an ongoing exhibit called Nuts and Bolts. The exhibit will be at Gallery 66 in New Britain until September 10th. More info at nbindustrial.org.
That's Where We Live's executive producer, Katie Talarski. Where We Live is produced by Katie along with Tucker Ives and Lydia Brown. I'm John Dankosky. Thanks for joining us.